Hello and welcome to episode 73 of the Mini PC Show, Big Talk Small Computers. Dor, how the heck are you, buddy?
Mildly crazy. How about you, man?
I'm good. I was back at the Hughes Compound Southern Command. I am currently at the Hughes Outpost Midwest Command, and I got some stuff to talk about. And we have Brian the Cable Guy. How are you doing?
Fantastic, guys. What's cooking?
I miss you, man.
Yeah, same here. It's been a little while.
Yeah, had Florida trip, and then just pure exhaustion, because I don't know about you guys. Vacation kills me, and I can't wait to come back to work where I have some semblance of control, and I can actually know what to expect day in, day out, where I can get at least a little bit of rest.
I hear you. Yeah, unfortunately, my flight back got in at 12:30 a.m. I did make it back to my apartment at 1:30 a.m. and, back to work at 8:30 the next morning.
Busy, busy, busy. That sounds wicked busy.
Yeah, yeah. So, I actually, not exactly mini PC, but I did install a 8-camera security system. It's wired, which meant I kind of spelunked through the truss work and blown in insulation to drag wires all across the rafter space of my home. And yeah, at 8 or 9 a.m., it was fairly cool, and that volume heated up very rapidly in the Florida sun to well over 100 degrees. But the way it doesn't exactly link into mini PCs is that the best way to view it is like on an Android phone, so I'm kind of dovetailing that in there. The system, it was an 8-camera system, was $400. It's called EasyViz, and so far I'm pretty much liking it.
Well, you know my question, right, Rich?
Is does it phone home?
Is do you have root? And if you want can give new listeners a description of what we mean by when we say do you have root.
Well, okay, so there's, I don't know if you're making reference to my constant rant about root, and if you don't have root, you don't own it, because apparently earlier versions of this, the software distribution allowed you a web browser connection, so from, whatever browser apparently you used to be able to connect in. If you have root access, basically you have complete control over a device. In Linux, root is the super user or administrator that has all control to do everything.
Yeah, and the layman's example I will give to everyone this week, because it's hot and topical, is you don't have root on Facebook. You log into Facebook, they own everything. Every single thing you do, everything you post, everything you install on their device, you know, I think they have root, not you. You are basically a third party to anything they do, and people learn what kinds of things are being done with their information after the fact. Where if you install IoT appliance in your home and you don't have root, it isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just potentially dangerous thing, because the other company might not keep their thing up to date on security, or just have weak security, or could be just negligent and not keep things up to date. But
or the worst case scenario is the TCP connected bulbs from GreenWave that I had. You did have SSH capability into the device to do things. It did have a direct web interface. They killed the direct web interface, and then they killed their service that allowed you to, hook it into IFT and other things. And the bird, for some reason, is communicating. The problem with these things is the terms of service are subject to change. In infotainment systems on cars, like you'll hear me rant about, my Genesis Coupe is running Windows CE, and I have the Ultimate Edition, which is the highest-end version of the car. The two lower-end versions of the car got Android Auto and Apple CarPlay retro on it, but I guess there's no cross-compatible product with my product line or product/model line, and therefore the highest-end version of it never got Android Auto or Apple CarPlay. And if you had root, you may have been able to do it yourself.
Yeah, to where now the only way you could do that kind of thing yourself is literally by taking a screwdriver to your dash and taking it apart, which I can't blame anybody for not wanting to do, because, you know, you shouldn't have to, is the logic. The only, no, I'm not going to say it like that, because that's negative. One upside could be if the camera system is stupid. If it doesn't have a lot of smarts, if it doesn't have a lot of horsepower, if it doesn't have a lot of storage, if it doesn't have a lot of potential behind it, then not having Root is not as big of a deal. If all it is just IP cameras and a very simple web interface, then hopefully that means that there's less that could go wrong. But the less moving parts, the easier it is for them to get it to work. So I would hope that's the case.
Well, the other thing, so kind of branching a little bit more into the mini PC world, is so it runs on phones and tablets of both the Android species and the iPhone species. I tried to sideload the app on the Fire Stick. While I was successful with that, the controls just did not work out right. And my hope was that it would give anybody in the house the ability on a TV to view the cameras, the security cameras, which unfortunately didn't quite go so well.
Could it maybe be you have to have the Google Play framework installed?
Maybe. I don't know. I'll have to check that out.
Well, and mouse, I don't even know if it is installable on a Fire Stick, but I heavily suspect it is. I guess related tangentially in mini PC news is Apple, I believe today, announced, in air quotes, new tablets. From everything I at least saw, the only new thing is it supports now their overpriced Pen, and for schools it's now $300. I didn't see anything else, at least.
The Pen new, or the tablet?
The tablet itself. Which, of course, if any self-respecting school buys one of these, then they immediately also have to buy the Pen so they can justify the reason to buy the tablet. And then once they buy the tablet, they have to then purchase the keyboard, because kids are going to eventually have to type something on these things. And I cannot expect them to expect kids to use on-screen keyboards for any real length of time.
I think they're all better off using Chromebooks.
And see, that's where you went, is by the time you added up all of those individual products, because I did this with an Acer with my wife. You know, she wanted a tablet. We got her a tablet. Then they had a keyboard, and it ended up over $400 completely. I could have bought her a low-end laptop, or, you know, just like Brian said, there are some really nice Chromebooks out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we just picked up one a little while ago. It turns into a tablet, flips over, does the yoga pose, you know, tent mode, all the latest features these days, and you can run Android apps on it. It's a no-brainer. I thought it was like under $300.
Yeah, there are nice. And if you're a Wise shopper, you can find sometimes a deal at Costco for $200 or $300 with an Intel Celeron Chromebook. That's what was it? I think I was looking at like a 14-inch.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I guess tangentially again from that, I don't know if you guys saw Acer at least announced, I don't believe it's available for purchase yet, the first official Chrome OS tablet is going to be launched. It to me was too much money for what it is. I want to say it was, again, $300 just for the tablet. The specs on it were fair, but I don't know if this thing is going to be successful, can be successful, or should be successful. But I think we all knew the idea of a Chrome tablet was coming, just we weren't sure how far away.
Yeah, I agree. Now that you can run Android apps in Chrome OS, I think this is going to fill a pretty interesting space. So I'm very curious to see how well they're going to do with this in the market.
Yeah, I want to say it was $329 for the tablet. And to be frank, between us here, it has a bit more of a bezel than I expected in 2018, to be very honest. The specs were fair. They were not, to me, in any way remarkable or shocking or great. They just seemed okay.
No, I agree. And when you say fair, so what would you expect to blow you away?
Well, okay, it is a 9.7 2048 by 1536 display, just like the iPad. Front and rear cameras, no mention of the camera quality. It estimated 9 hours battery life. My Chromebook gets 10 plus easy hours of battery life. An OP1 processor, which I'm not completely sure what that is. 4 gigabytes of RAM. 4 is good for a Chromebook. I'm not going to say it's fantastic. 32 gigs of internal space. Everybody is addicted to believing they need immense amounts of storage on all their devices. To me, 32 on a Chrome OS-based device is plenty fine. Does have a USB port and a micro SD card slot. But I'll say, it does come with some kind of stylus, which seems fine. It has a built-in Wacom-branded stylus. I hope the actual screen is Wacom compatible. The processor seems fair, I'm going to say. Looking more into it, it doesn't seem great. So it seems fine. But for 4 gigs of RAM, and what I consider a standard 10-inch screen, I would hope it would be closer to 220, 240.
No, yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's the price is a bit steep, but it is new too, so I can see that coming down a bit.
Yeah, and Chromebooks are destroying it in schools. There is nothing that is even remotely starting to even begin to even hurt the sales of Chromebooks in schools because of the management interface that it has. Because of the fact that they can easily lock them down, because of the fact that they're full keyboards, because of the fact that a lot of the manufacturers have antimicrobial keyboards and stuff on them, and the fact that they're at least semi-ruggedized. Lenovo at Mobile World Expo just showed off a 297 semi-ruggedized school education-based Chromebook. To me, if you want to convince me as a school district to buy an iPad, it literally has to be nearly $100 left because you have to buy all the other infrastructure for it. Not just the keyboard, not just the stylus, not just the case, but you have to have the time and effort into learning the management of it. And then you have to buy all of the extra hardware so you can have racks, so you can charge them and everything else. Because you know the iPad's not going to use any kind of standard charging port because that would be just foolish.
Yeah, that's what Apple does. Yeah, the Google Classroom, my kids have Chromebooks in all their schools, and the Google Classroom is a pretty good ecosystem that they have. That pairs with the actual Chromebook. So, you know, we get updates when they complete their homework, and teacher sends out updates and so forth as far as, you know, what the kids are doing and everything. So it's a good way to stay in touch with teachers without going through email all the time too as well.
And give me one second, I gotta relaunch the spreadsheet because I guess we're riding the tangential wave tonight because the next thing I wanted to talk about was line 637 in the notes, which is equally as expensive as a Chromebook or as an iPad, but I don't think it's quite as desirable, useful, or functional.
1980 wants its Zorus back.
I know. It's called a Gemini PDA, which actually I want to say had a Kickstarter a while ago. 449, I believe it's euros. I'm blind and it's small text, which converts to $700+ for this thing.
No way. No way, Dor. I can't believe you even put this in there.
Well, it's a mini computer, is it not? I mean, we got to talk mini computers.
No, I agree. I wow, that's really expensive.
Wah, 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 wah. Who's got the sand trombone going?
Well, I wish.
This fits into the same category of the Pi 3B Plus.
Well,
as far as disappointment.
Well, I'm not really that disappointed in the new Pi.
Well, and I'll say this isn't a disappointment. I mean, personally, I think this is at least moderately a sexy device. It's not ridiculous looking. It isn't like it's huge and clunky. It's actually small and compact. It's just irrationally priced. It's just insane. I mean, if And they do have one with a Wi-Fi only version, and they have one with some kind of 4G Wi-Fi, which of course will have very questionable US connectivity possibility. But the specs on it aren't horrible. It's a let me see. It has essentially 10 cores, four high. It looks like two super high cores, four high cores, four low cores. 4 gigabytes of RAM, micro SD card, 64 gigs of internal space, and can run full-blown Linux on it or Android on it. So I really like the versatility of it. I just cannot comprehend how much they're paying for it. I'm sure whoever buys it, they're going to convince themselves they like it because they spent so much money. But to me, this should be closer to $200, $250 maybe.
Yeah, this is... something's going on here with
unless it has 10-day battery life, you know.
Yeah, well, it's maybe something to do with manufacturing, or you have partners that just can't afford to get this thing out of the door. Mm-hmm. You know, they just have to pad the price somehow. But looking at the screen, it looks like they can go a good inch and a half or more to fill that screen a little wider. The screen seems a little cramped, I think.
I agree. And the battery life, it's only a 4,000 milliamp battery. If you have 4G connectivity with it, this probably will not last all day with any kind of moderate use. If it's Wi-Fi only, 4,000 milliamp, you could see all day camera, all day battery life out of it. But it's the kind of thing I'm not going to place any wagers on.
Yeah, I can't see them selling a whole lot of these things.
Okay, I'm just looking at the image, and the keys are above the deck of the bottom part. If the lid clamshells down on it, the keys are all going to be depressed.
That's right. There's got to be some kind of cancellation in the software.
Or, I don't know, as you close the lid, all the keys might go down a little bit.
But... I'm wondering if this is just a 3D rendering and not an actual product.
Mm. Well, if you look at the woman in the coffee shop there, kind of using it. I don't know. Is it vaporware?
Yeah, I could wrap aluminum around a piece of 3D printed plastic and it'd look exactly like that picture.
I'll say, zooming in on the picture of the woman using it, it doesn't look like the keys come up that much beyond the rim, if they do come up beyond the rim. Where in the standalone pictures of the device, it definitely looks like that.
Yeah, these look like full machine keys, not the what do you call it?
Not even like a MacBook. Yeah. Not even like a MacBook Pro.
Yeah, and then if you want to jump on the obvious news, the Raspberry Pi B Plus 8, first off, they failed. They failed in every single possible way.
Oh, come on. Don't be too hard.
It should have been the Pi 3.14. What the hell's wrong with it? It's a name. All it is a name. And they're too utterly ridiculously incompetent to even do that right. Now, the devil's advocate is they were too busy. They were too busy thinking about either buying Qualcomm or getting bought by Intel, because those were both of the rumors in the last couple of weeks that either Broadcom was going to buy somebody else, Qualcomm, and then the U.S. government said, we don't think you should do that. And then the other rumor was Intel was going to buy all of Broadcom because Intel is getting their lunch handed to them on all ARM-based stuff. The ARM chips are selling like ridiculously, and their chips are not. And that apparently just turned into nothing. So all of that news around it, and then we get a new Raspberry Pi B Plus that I don't really see much different with it. I mean, much worth even mentioning.
So the good is it's the same price. The bad is the specs are somewhat upgraded. Really, the big thing is you have gigabit Ethernet running at third gigabit Ethernet speed, and you have 802.11ac now.
But it looks like the fastest speed you will ever get out of that NIC is theoretical 300 megabytes, realistically in the 200 megabyte, 220 to 260 megabyte range.
Why do you say that?
Because people have already done benchmark testing on them, and
the Ethernet is hung off USB 2 chipset.
Yeah, so it's gigabit in name only, because while the actual port itself can physically handle 1 gig, the bus that it's connected to cannot handle 1 gig.
I believe that was the same limitation as its predecessor, so I'm kind of curious why they would kind of offer it as a 1 gig and not change the architect.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, and so just to, you know, not throw them completely down the whatever, but look, they're offering this at $35, and I think I said this on the last show. What do you expect for $35? You expect a complete architecture redesign with brand new chipset?
No, I mean, if I'm gonna offer you the limited edition, you would hope that you're getting the limited edition. You know what I mean?
Well, if you want my answer, Rich, they needed to offer something. I don't want to say anything, something. USB 3 is the far-reaching thing that I don't expect them to do, because that would also mean they would have to change the power port.
Mm-hmm.
More RAM. There's no reason why they couldn't have quadrupled the RAM, because other people are doing it.
So 4 gigs of RAM.
To be honest, yes.
Yeah.
A true gig NIC would have been nice. There's plenty of faster processors out there. Or hell, why not throw an open source GPU on the damn thing? Again, and still, the one thing is constant. If you're brand new into mini PCs, or you demand to have as much broad support from different places as possible, or you want to be able to follow the hip kids tutorials that they keep throwing out, then yes, you still have no choice but to get a Pi 3. And I do say that with a slight snarky tone to my voice, because I personally believe, the very first podcaster to ever mention the Raspberry Pi and what it could do, what it could mean, how it could impact everything. And I pushed it and I believed in it. And I still believe in its overall mission statement. I just have less and less and less faith in the company behind it as time moves on. We have companies like Odroid pushing the limits hard. We have people like Pine trying to push the limits hard. We have Raspberry Pi doing little TikTok updates, or tick updates. They're not even doing the talk. They're just ticking, 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 ticking. I'm not buying one of these. And as of right now, I'm not buying one of these. And I, for the future, don't see myself buying one of these, because I don't see any use case for me for one of these.
So and kind of just so everybody understands, gets the right message, I always advocate for the first device you get in the mini PC realm is whatever the current version of a Raspberry Pi is. So kudos to them at keeping the price at $35. It's not one of these things where I'm going to toss all of the Raspberry Pi 3s that I have out there and replace them with, you know, the B plus. It's not driving me to the store to do it. And like Dor said, there are some great high horsepower alternatives out there, and I am, you know, absolutely an enthusiast with that. You know, it's like kid in the candy store. Oh, and give props to Micro Center. On March 14th, they had the Pi Zero W for $3.14.
Oh wow, I missed that.
That's awesome. And I'll say, everything I said comes from a first world perspective. And I mean that insulting myself by saying it. As a first worlder, I'm now, there's no more shine left on the Raspberry Pi 3. I'm not at all enthused about it or wanting it. The Pi Zero has plenty of room where they could do an improvement to make that thing really desirable to someone like me. But if I stick with what it says its core usage is, which is smaller countries building up ecosystems and schools and education systems, I'll say it's a good rev. It's a sensible rev. It's the rev that they needed to maintain that foothold in that ecosystem. So I have no problem buying Raspberry Pi 3s for those people. I have no problem donating Raspberry Pi 3s to those people. And if I'm buying a board for those people, I would much rather buy a $35 computer versus a $55 or $65 computer, because then I'll get twice as much out of that same amount of money. So as far as that use case is concerned, I think it's great. My logical question is, why don't you offer, dare I say, the first world version and then the rest of the world version, to where the sales of the first world version can help prop up and support the manufacturing and distribution of the third world version?
I'd like to listen to what their mission is. So what, you know, what are they trying to do? Are they trying to offer a product for educational purposes, you know, to get individuals a foothold, or to get dip their toe in the water as far as the program is concerned and learning electronics and robotics? Or are they trying to sell us a product where we could actually go do whatever we want with it? Because I agree with you, Dor. If this was something, you know, if I'm a power user and I'm used to using devices such as Odroids and things like that, and I'm looking at the Raspberry Pi, I'm gonna pass on it. But if my interest is purely educational and I'm donating a bunch away for folks that want to, like I said, dip their toe and get them started, then yeah, I am going to actually turn to the Raspberry Pi to do that with, because it's, you can't beat the price.
Yeah. And if I, Door to Door Geek, had to state what was their target. Their target is stationary prices, so projects that were already underway can still maintain the way that they were going. Stability. The Raspberry Pi 3 B Plus now is among the most stable pieces of hardware in mini computing I think I've ever seen in my life. And stable is one of those things a lot of people don't put a price on, but there are a lot of people out there who don't know that they need it, but they really do need stability. And the Raspberry Pi 3 does offer that. And from the beginning, I can't remember the guy's name who works for Broadcom, who started this up as a side project, stated his goal was to put as many of these in poor, underdeveloped countries to help the kids know what a computer is, how does a computer work, even teach them how to code so they could have a job to help provide for their community in ways that their parents could not. So education and distribution of information and technology to the masses was the goal from the beginning. It wasn't to get some white 45-year-old living in a suburb to set up a Internet of Things server in his house. And I'm the white 45-year-old guy in the suburbs. and just really quick, coreelectronics.com.au has a decent little write-up here about the performance differences between the 3 and the 3B Plus. The biggest improvement overall is networking, period, bar none. It blows the doors off of every other difference in the two devices. The CPU performance peaked at 19% faster. Once you go above 10% faster in a processor, that's where I believe you can start to see a difference. So 19% is a measurable difference that you probably should be able to notice. On the memory, 20% faster. Again, whenever you're doing anything especially desktop-like on these mini computers, RAM is where you're going to see your differences. So faster RAM will mean a much better pixel desktop on your Raspberry Pi. Ethernet speed, 257% faster. Clearly, if networking is your priority on these devices, you will definitely see a speed improvement if you're doing wired networking. Power usage, 38% more. That's one of those silent upgrades that I think is really good, because if I'm running my thing off a battery pack or I'm in a country where power is not cheap, getting 38% more out of the same amount of power is definitely desirable. Temperature is only 4% lower, so the heat thing is going to be the same. But like I said in the very beginning of this, the Raspberry Pi is among the most stable mini computers in existence. And part of it is, I think, is that they do a good job maintaining the heat.
What's the speed now? They've bumped it from 1.2 to 1.4.
Or I'm reading the section on power, and I think you're incorrect. I think it's using 38% more power.
Oh, crikey. I thought it was 38% more efficient.
Yeah, if you look at the table, it's showing the Pi 3 like boot 0.72 amps and the Pi 3 Plus at 0.85, idle at 0.32, and on the 3 and the 3 Plus 0.52, and then load at 0.8 amps and on the Pi 3 Plus 1.13 amps.
Okay, well, you have better eyes than me. Thank you.
Oh, you know what else they have, too, is the power over Ethernet.
No, they don't.
I thought that was available.
Order board.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they did PoE on board, I'd be all in.
That would be a big plus. I would say that. Yeah, so if you are brand new getting into these mini computers, I suggest everybody, your first device, your beginner, your intro, your tutorial level almost always has to be a Raspberry Pi, just because 99% of the things you read out there on any website talking about doing anything with these mini computers, they're almost always going to tell you how to do it on a Raspberry Pi first and foremost. Especially if you're newer to Linux, you better get a Raspberry Pi 3 or else you will probably go moderately insane trying to get everything working. Okay, here's a link that I wanted to make sure that you guys saw. One, so you could evaluate, but two, to see if it's any good or not. Line 363 in the notes, the URL for the listeners.
363?
I thought it was
633.
It's just a little dyslexia. You got to pardon it. Yes, 636, board-db.org. Okay, this is not perfect. I'll say up front, to expect perfection is planned disappointment. So we've said on this show many, many times, it is very difficult to stay up to date on all of the different boards that are coming out. We've talked about on some shows 10 different boards on a single show. There was still probably twice as many new boards that week. It's really difficult to stay on top of them. On this website, they right now have 244 different boards in their database what I think is a decent searchable system where you can find things that you're looking explicitly for. Like one of the things I was looking for earlier in the week was boards with Raspberry Pi pinout compatibility, which is just a checkbox in this. I click search and then, bam, I see all the boards listed that have the Raspberry Pi-like pinouts, everything from the Banana Pi, B1, Rose Apple Pi, so forth and so on and so forth and so on. If you want different ways to search, different ways to look for, different ways to look at boards, I honestly am kind of liking this website. Again, it's not perfect, but I thought it was pretty good.
Cool. And I did the same check I did like a week ago when you posted this link. And so I just checked Ethernet and I checked Gigabit, and it came up with a bunch of results. I think last week it only had a couple of results, but there's, you know, like two dozen now.
Yeah, I did the same exact thing, Rich. When I first got the link, 'cause this is a pretty cool website. Thank you, Dor.
Yeah, this is the kind of website I'm going to make sure I have correctly tagged in my Gitpocket. So at the drop of a dime, I can go back to it and look up stuff, because you know, the only constant in these boards are change and, you know, new ones coming out. So every week or so, I just want to come back, see how many boards are they adding to their database, and then once in a while, just let me see the board with the most RAM that's not a Jetson type board, or let me see a board that has different USB 3 ports on it or something like that, just so I can see if there's stuff that I'm missing. Well, and one of the things I didn't notice before, but I notice now, some of the boards they even have views on. Like when I searched for SATA connectors, I noticed that they have the Banana Pi Pro, and they say 3.4 out of 5 stars beneath the description, and not all the boards say that. So some of the boards, they actually have like reviews on, which I think can be quite handy.
So, Dora, I want to ask you, you got a new, somebody donated to you a Banana Pi Pro, right?
Yes. Richard Klein gave me one, and I have one running my own cloud.
And did you switch over to Nextcloud on that yet, or how are you doing on that?
It's going exactly as planned so far. No, which I haven't switched it over yet. No.
Okay. And the reason I kind of dovetailed into that is for many years, I've had my Banana Pro running CrashPlan, and something happened to it after I left the Hughes Compound Southern Command and came up here to the Midwest Outpost. My root file system filled up, and you know, I didn't realize that till I got back here. I'm like, all right, I got the Ethernet working, and you know, I tried getting backup working because I had very little time to play with my data center in a drawer. Anyhow, all of that. I'm going to bring you onto line 641. I may have a new favorite backup tool. So this checks a couple of boxes, and it's open source. It's cross-platform. It's ARM-based. In, of course, my favorite distro, DietPi, you can just check a box and install it. It's called SyncThing, and SyncThing works just like Rosello Sync or BitSync, sorry, Rosello Sync or BitTorrent Sync. And can anybody say Irish wristwatch three times fast?
No.
Okay. So I've only slightly more than smoke tested this. So I hate to, you know, like all sorts of, you know, prop it up, brag about it. But it also seems to me that it will do off network syncing. So that's kind of cool also. So you don't necessarily have to be on the same LAN or network when you're doing this. So I'll have to report back next show or, you know, on the Google Plus on how it's going, because I'm only a couple of days into testing it and I didn't get a full backup. I left it plugged in on a gigabit NIC on my MacBook Pro and over to the ROC 64. And I think my MacBook Pro went to sleep because only 3% of the MacBook synced over, and that would have happened in a few minutes.
Gotcha, gotcha. I'll say I can see why or how you could use this for your solution, but this is not something that I can remotely use for my solution. I need a full multi-user environment type system. This is more or less a backup.
Oh, yeah, it's backup only. I didn't mean to say it was like a Nextcloud replacement or anything.
But I'll say this. I did use BitTorrent Sync for a while, for a good while, and it was damn easy. I mean, there was little you could do to mess it up. It just ran to me that good. The problem with BitTorrent Sync was they could not get the traction they wanted to because it was connected with the word BitTorrent, and no business wants anything labeled BitTorrent running inside their network. So they basically sold it off, and that company never open sourced the actual source code behind it. So it was not trusted by a lot of people I know. Where SyncThing came out of the gate later than BitTorrent Sync, they had a good amount of catching up to do. I'd say in under a year, they more than called up to BitTorrent Sync. And now, to me, from what I see by these screenshots and everything, they completely blew away BitTorrent Sync and at least functionality and interface. So this is good looking. So because it's DietPi, you said, so this is completely ARM compatible, no issues with that at all. That's a good plan.
Yeah, and so it's completely cross-platform, and even like exotic platforms. I'm not just talking, you know, Windows, Linux, whatever. You know, there's like BSD and a bunch of others that it's compatible with. So the UI runs in a browser, so it's a browser-based UI.
And it is a client-server-based application, not a client-less, right?
Right, like Duplicati is serverless. You basically run Duplicati on your device and say there is some resource. And Duplicati is powerful in that it could be the S3 cloud, it could be Azure, it could be anything. It could be an NFS share, it could be a Samba share. So Duplicati was very cool because it was like kind of back-end agnostic, whereas this is definitely a client server, or a, you know, Both App is the client server, kind of like how CrashPlan was. It's more similar to a peer-to-peer backup, you know, as the original BitTorrent.
Gotcha. And to me, there's always a trade-off on these things. Client server type structured applications have unbelievable amount of configuration compared to a clientless solution. The downside is you can only back up devices that they provide the install media for. So hypothetically, on a clientless solution, all you have to have is either a network share or an FTP server running on a device that it can access, or SSH that it can access, and then you just have it as an open network share. So hypothetically, on my Android device, if I had a folder on it that I could share over the network, a clientless backup solution could back that folder up without blinking. Where a client server application, I would actually need an Android installer for it to be able to back up from that. So that's the only, to me, end user difference between the two types of backups. And with the client server backup, again, the functionality you get out of it. And if you take a look at the stat screen on SyncThing, you are utterly aware of exactly how this server is running. What is its throughput? Is there any slow points? What's going on in the server? You know what's going on. There is no doubt.
And I don't know if I mentioned it, it also does versioning. So you can select simple versioning and the number of versions of a file that you want to keep. I haven't tested how the restore process works yet because I haven't completed a backup yet. So if it all goes as planned, hopefully next time I return to the Hughes Compound Southern Command, I'm going to nuke and pave CrashPlan and drop this in.
Well, I'm going to make a prediction of my own. That is, restoring from a current version is a snap, is literally click, bang, done. To restore from a previous version might be a slight headache, but I do believe they would have most of it figured out in a streamlined fashion, but it's still going to be a little bit of work. Which is fair, because most backup applications have horrible restore interfaces, in my experience.
Yeah, and I think that's why I like CrashPlan a lot, is the backup UI was very nice.
Very cool. They have installers for Linux, Windows, Mac OS X, FreeBSD, Solaris, Dragonfly BSD, NetBSD, OpenSourceBSD, and SourceCode on their website. And then they also have Google Play and F-Droid, which I'm pretty sure that's just a management interface. That's not the actual server itself for those two.
You forgot MIPS, MIPS LE, PowerPC, PowerPC 64 LE.
I didn't see them. And so this is really functional. And to me, to call this a backup thing is almost in limiting it. It's a combination folder synchronization tool and backup at the same time, which to me, you can do both. You just got to realize when you have that folder on your computer, you really shouldn't be working out of it. If you're going to be working on those files, my logic is you copy it into a different folder, do your work on that file, then when you're done, you put it back in that syncing folder.
Yeah, and it could be considered a collaboration thing that way, or really one person collaboration. And so you could have your work machine, your home machine, your whatever, and they all could sync. So that one directory where you dropped something would all sync together if you just select to sync one directory.
That sounds pretty brilliant.
Very cool.
Yeah, I really like that. You definitely keep us posted, Rich.
Oh yeah, because I'm like, I hate to again, you know, we talked about root, and if it's not root, if it's not open source, if it's not fill in the blank, three other things, you don't own it. And I was super, super, super happy with CrashPlan. And I was, you know, super happy with it running on my Banana Pi. And I thought I had the, you know, uber penultimate solution because it worked, you know, Linux, Mac, PC. And we're very heterogeneous in my household. And just really, I'm ticked off at CrashPlan. But fine, if your cloud service isn't making money, I completely understand it. It's business. Terminate that. That's fine. But when you're doing peer-to-peer and it's been out there a long time, and I recognize it's not open source, it's not shareware, freeware, whateverware, they own it. They should have said, hey, I'll pay me $200 for a site license, you know, an unlimited site license or something. I would have done it. I absolutely, if they said one-time fee, $200, you got unlimited site license, I would have done it. So the big thing for me on this is it's open source. There's no, you know, third party involved in it. So I can use this. It's cross-platform versioning. Those are the big features in my mind.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'll say for me, backup, just a quick side note, my backup strategy is very lazy and incompetent. I use my own cloud on a couple of my boxes here. And then what I have is I have a rsync tool that runs periodically, and it copies key folders from my own cloud, not many of it, not a majority of it, not even, you know, a lot, to another folder where I have my InSync, InSync application that I paid for to sync folders to my Google Drive. And what I'll say is, what I do backup is non-personal information. There is nothing on any of my computers that has any social security numbers, birthdays, any of that information whatsoever. I have nothing on any of my computers with any personal identifiable information. Most of the stuff I back up is Podnuts domain, things like that. Everything when I have personal identifiable information on something, I literally use it and then I shred it. If I have to send a PDF to somebody, I send it securely, and then I remove all remnants of it from every device, every single drive I have. So I really don't back up stuff. And pictures, as far as pictures are concerned, I don't take pictures because I'm a privacy nut, I guess is what I'll say. I don't like the idea of taking pictures of anybody without extreme explicit consent.
Wow, you don't use Google Photos or anything like that?
Most of the time when I take a picture, it's of my cup or something I want to show somebody. I feel like me taking a picture of my kid and then putting it on Facebook, Twitter, Google Photos, or anything is at least a soft violation of their personal right to privacy. So I don't do that. Again, I'm a nut.
No, you make sense. It's not that far-fetched.
Well, and I have no problem admitting, it stems from my self-esteem issue, not wanting to have pictures taken of myself because I think I look ridiculously like, you know, there's a chromosome missing or something. But I digress. Was there any other links in the notes that caught your guys' eyes as being exciting or interesting?
Well, I was looking at 640, Brian's. Anytime there's an Intel chipped mini PC type device, that always piques my interest.
Yeah, I posted this because we had Azul not too long ago launch a product similar to this, and this is the HDMI TV mini PC stick that you can slide into the back of your TV. Not directly, because these things are fairly large for an HDMI port, so you'll have to have like a small little 3-inch HDMI extender, sort of hang off a little bit, but I digress too. What caught my eye on this one, you have the built-in gigabit Ethernet port, which I thought was pretty cool because the Azul's product only had 10/100, and this particular device comes from Melee, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, I do believe it's Melee, and they ain't new to this either. Melee has been making set-top box / HDMI stick computers for at least 3 to 5 years or so. So this is not their first go around, which makes me feel a whole lot better. A Intel chip, while we know it's not going to be a tremendous powerhouse of a chip, that does mean it will be a very compatible chip. The gigabit NIC to me is the kind of thing, well, if you have a TV within reach of a router with speeds, I don't know what you couldn't stream to this device. And it looks like it even has multiple USB 3.0 ports on it as well. So I don't know what this stick couldn't handle kind of thing. It should be able to handle a hell of a lot.
Yeah, it's got the latest Apollo Lake processor, which is, gives it a little bit of a boost too as well in performance. The only thing that I really don't like about this, and I kind of chatted about it on the Google Plus forum, is the 32 gigs of storage.
Big.
Yeah, and I know why they're doing that. I mean, as far as licenses is concerned with Windows 10, but it... it's really, really difficult trying to run this machine, even just as something to go online and doing a couple of quick searches on a few things and sending out a few emails with 32 gigs of storage. You either have to use this specifically for streaming video, and that's it, or find some way to to get some additional storage out of this thing. It's just, it's really hard.
Well, yeah, Windows and less than 60 gig disk is dangerous. It's a game of Russian roulette. If anybody is running Windows on a 32 gig drive, note to self, disk cleanup utility. Run that often, literally at least once a month, preferably every 2 weeks, to clear up your disk of any temporary unused files or Windows update kind of files, because Windows does not like getting higher than 80% filled on their disk. So while it says 32 gig, let's just first all agree, 32 gig is never 32 gig. It's closer to 30 gig. And then if we say 30 gig and Windows likes to have at least 20% filled, you're now pushing down closer to, I believe, 27, 26 gig before you'll start seeing slowdowns and things happening. So Windows disk cleanup utility will be your friend. And you can get this off of AliExpress, at least right now, with a deluxe Air Mouse for $199 without the Air Mouse for $179. And I will say, with a proper input device, this could be a really good home theater PC type experience.
Yeah, I fully agree with you, Dor.
So if it was $125, I'd be crazy excited.
Yeah, and the only thing not in the pictures, at least here, is what does the power brick or power adapter look like. Not that it's a make or break situation. I'll say, I have that Air Mouse. That Air Mouse sucks. I just got to say that out loud. It is a absolutely horrible Air Mouse that's completely flaky and does not work great. The keyboard works fine, but the Air Mouse part just doesn't work great. But this is the kind of thing where I really don't want a huge power brick connected to it. It'd be nice if you could connect it via USB to the TV for power, but I'm going to guess because of the USB 3, that's not going to happen.
Well, I saw it said USB and 3 amps. That's a lot. All right, yeah, power supply, 5 volt, 3 amps, micro USB port. 3 amps is a stink load of current.
Yeah, and I do like the fact that the Wi-Fi has a physical antenna. So technically speaking, even if you're not getting great wireless service, because it has a physical antenna, you could hack the antenna, take it off, extend it, put the antenna someplace else, and get better connectivity. So I like the versatility of the device, and I agree, if it was $30, $40, $50 less, this would be a no-brainer.
Looks like you can run Linux on here too as well. Whereas the Azul, I don't think, matter of fact, I don't think you can install anything else but Windows 10. But I was actually poking around in the BIOS, and there were some options to install Android. So I'm not too sure what that was all about.
Gotcha. And I believe if you take a look at the front of the remote, the fly remote, fly mouse kind of thing, I believe there is even dedicated Android buttons on the front of that thing.
Oh, yeah. So let me ask you, I've never ran Linux on 32 gigs of storage. How is that the same experience as Windows, or how is that?
Oh, no, there. I'll say this. Anything long-term, if you don't do correct cleanup after updates, you will sooner or later run out of disk space. Because with kernel updates, the question is, how often does this thing get kernel updates? I'm going to expect not very often. So you could probably run this thing off of 10 gigs of space for 2 years before space becomes an issue. Unless, of course, you're loading a lot of local files to it. Your typical Linux install, you can get with 8 gigs, between 8 and 10 gigs. And the only time you have issues with filling up a disk is when they have a separate root partition for the kernel and you get frequent kernel updates. I've seen people in about a year run out of space where we got to do a auto clean, auto remove on their Linux desktop to free up some space.
Gotcha.
Okay, one of the things I just wanted to mention, I guess offhandedly, because I don't know how much hands-on experience you guys have, now it's line 636, 37, 38, I guess all of them, WebOS. WebOS is the operating system that everyone was in love with at least a while ago, but it has been remarkably quiet for at least 2 years now. But now it looks like LG launches a open source version of WebOS out into the free world kind of thing. And I know with the old HP touchpads running WebOS, people swore up and down how good that operating system was and how Android and iOS stole a lot of its features and made them normal to the end user because they were done so right. Do you guys have any experience with WebOS?
Only on my TV.
Yeah, I'll say I had a WebOS HP touchpad tablet for a week, and then I just got rid of the damn thing. I understood what they were trying to do. It was underpowered. It did not run great. To me, it's a tablet. You either love tablets or hate tablets. There's nothing in the middle. I don't know if this is going to take off. I don't know how this can take off. I don't know if this would take off. But now it's put in to an open source edition. I guess we have to wait and see if people are going to pick up on it or not.
Yeah, I get the same response from someone who had a WebOS tablet a few years back. And, they swore up and down. They loved it. It was the next best thing. Obviously, it just fell off, you know. So I'm curious to see what this is all about. If they've changed anything that makes it a the best seller, so I'm curious.
Yeah, the only other thing I was wanting to mention, and only because I saw a tweet, which of course I don't really browse Twitter that much, but I did see a tweet, line 643, Armbian. Now, really quick high-level description. Like the Pixel Raspbian OS is your all-purpose general thing. It's like the CUV. It's like an SUV of operating systems. It can do a bunch of different things. None of them perfect, none of them great, but it can do a bunch of different things. Then you have DietPie. DietPie is like the kit car. It's the thing that once you get it, you can make it anything. You can make it a sports car. You can make it a limousine. You can make it a trailer. You know, DietPie can become almost anything you want it to become. Then there is Armbian. Armbian, I believe, is a more pure Debian base, but it is maybe the most highly optimized for desktop usage like that I've seen out of one of these mini PC operating systems. They do a lot of hardware optimization on the drivers for the graphics. And it looks like Armbian now has a testing version of Ubuntu server and Debian desktop. in development for the Rock 64. I'm not going to load this yet. I'm going to keep an eye on it. I want to see when they make more progress, when it's closer to being fully ready, because when I've ran Armbian desktops, I was always pleasantly surprised at the snappiness that I got out of it. It seemed almost unnatural how fast the desktops were running. The real wild card for me is going to be is how well does the wireless work and how well does the actual browser work? Because 99% of the things I do, it's going to be in the browser. But I am really still liking the Rock 64 right now, right now, right now. Rock 64 is to me still the performance board to get on a budget. You don't have to spend $100-$200 for it, and you get what I think is pretty good performance, up to 4 gigs of RAM. And I'm sure when Armbian gets fully done out of testing, it's going to be really good. Oh, and Armbian is one of the few distributions on first boot. They basically insist you have to change the password. Quick tangent. A friend of ours, and I don't know if he wants me to say who he is, so I'm not going to say who he is. He isn't the most network savvy fella. He admitted it to me. He wasn't sure if he had port forwarding turned on his router for his one Raspberry Pi he had in his house, but his Raspberry Pi got infected. Something logged into his Raspberry Pi, something changed his root password, and something put a extra stuff in his bash.rc. So every time the computer booted up, it was running its own code in the background doing things. We did a little research onto what it was. It wasn't like it was Bitcoin mining, or it wasn't like it was hosting horrible type content, but it was a compromised system. And I feel pretty safe in saying, without doing any actual forensics on it, if he would have changed the password, it wouldn't have happened. So that's one big, huge plus about Armbian is first time you boot it up, first thing you have to do, you have to change the password. So if you're running any of these mini computers and there's any remote chance you're going to have this thing accessible via any public internet, change the password. I don't care what you change the password to, just change the password, everybody.
Yeah, I gotta fully agree with you, Dora. That's just 101 type stuff. I know we fall victim to it, trying to get up and running and get going as fast as we can, but just doing the basics like that can save you a lot of headache down the road.
Yeah, like for years, people said Comcast did certain things, Verizon did certain things, Microsoft did certain things, and Apple did certain things just to reduce the amount of like help desk type tickets, you know what I mean? Complaint phone calls. People are saying that I've heard, well, Raspbian on first boot does not force you to change the password because they're afraid that would be too cumbersome for the newest of the newest of the newest user. I personally believe to some degree, it's actually quite incompetent of them to not at least encourage the person on first boot to change the password. I understand if you don't forcibly force them to, but you, in my opinion, should at least encourage them to. I do believe the only thing that they did, I believe, smart was, I do believe if you connect a fresh Raspberry Pi up, power it on, and there is no HDMI output, I do believe SSH is enabled by default, but if you have an HDMI connector plugged in and you log in physically onto the device, I think on first boot, it disables SSH, which is a help on towards good security, but the default password thing, I think, is one of those things it has to change.
This does look pretty snappy. Is this video accurate for the Armbian?
I haven't ran it, so I'm not going to say yes. I will say Armbian, in my experience in the past, has been nothing but lightning fast, literally almost unreal performance out of devices. The type of performance I didn't think was even possible out of some of my devices.
The boot on the Rock 64 is very fast.
Yeah.
Even with micro SD card.
Yeah, with my EMMC, I think it's safe to say it's less than 10 seconds. Realistically, I want to say it's maybe 7 seconds. But yeah, we'll have the link in the notes to the Armbian Rock 64 page where the video is linked below. And I will say the real hook or crook is going to be for me, how well does the browser work? Because unfortunately, I have no problem admitting to people in the public, 99% of everything I do on these mini computers is in the browser. And unless you guys have anything else, I think we're going to round third.
No, I'm good. I got to get my hands on one of these Rock 64 boards.
Okay. I want to ask the listeners and ask you guys if you can. I don't expect many people to be able to answer this question, but if you have time, listeners or guys, if you want to help me do some research, I need to find a solution. I want to record mini computing desktops, but I do not want to affect the performance of the mini computer. So my logic is I need a piece of dedicated hardware with HDMI in, HDMI out, and that hardware then would have, I guess, USB 3 to my desktop or my laptop where I can do the recording of the HDMI output from these mini computers. I'm finding very, and it has to be, of course, Linux compatible. I'm finding very mixed information out there. A huge, huge percentage of the people doing this are Windows users recording Xbox and PS4 kind of thing. So they're not doing what I'm doing. I need to record Raspberry Pi, Rock 64 type stuff, and I need to be able to do it on a Linux desktop.
Okay, we reviewed a couple of boards a couple of shows back, and one of them had an HDMI input.
No, none of the HDMI inputs on any of these mini boards support HDCP, which means they're not going to work for most of my needs. Yeah, I already did a little preliminary looking. Once in a while, I see it says Linux support, and then after I look into it, it turns out you need a custom kernel module, aka compile your own kernel, and then you also need custom versions of Wine installed, and you know, that's, to me, not a good solution. There has to be something out there, even if it is a dedicated piece of hardware that just records onto it. I would like to get something, is the logic. And if anybody out there has any information on this or has some Google foo on being able to figure this out, any and all help would definitely be a appreciated. So, hey, Brian, if people want to catch up with you, what's the easiest way to do that?
You can find me over at Google Plus, and then obviously send us an email.
The email, I believe, is minipcshow@podnuts.com. Hey, Rich, if people want to catch up with you, how can they do that?
Over at flyingrich.com, my social media hub, and you can see my Google Plus, so that's probably a good way to find me also.
Very cool, very cool. And if you, listener, enjoy the fact that the show is not interrupted roughly every 10 to 20 minutes with a ad for something that you don't care about whatsoever, breaking up the flow of the show or taking your personal time out of your day to listen to it. And if you want to say thanks, the easiest way is to go to patreon.com/minipcshow. That's the easiest way to show support. If you want to send us an email, again, it's minipcshow@podnuts.com. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, you can send it at 7076-PODNUT. And we do have a Google Plus community. Just search for minipcshow on Google Plus, and you will be able to find us hanging out there all the time. And with that, I want to thank everyone for their support for downloading, and we will talk to everyone again real soon.
This is Martin from PodNuts Pro. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast to be in your ears right now. Don't forget to support all the other PodNuts shows on the PodNuts Network. And we cannot do this without you. So please, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, email us at podnutspro@podnuts.com.